Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Can we just sit here and you answer the questions?
Okay.
What day is this day?
Special day for my birthday.
Oh, it's your birthday?
Yeah.
So it's August 3rd?
Yeah.
1982?
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing to do?
Have my birthday.
Have your birthday?
Yeah.
Hey, this is Sound Effect. I'm Kevin Kniestad, and that's my Uncle Brian, or as I used to call him, Uncle Babu, interviewing me when I was 3 years old.
What things do you like to do outside?
Play and everything.
And what?
Play and everything.
And everything?
Yeah.
What's everything?
Everything is a stump.
On the stump?
Yeah.
What do you do on the stump?
Play and get dirty.
Get dirty?
Yeah.
Do you have any imaginative friends?
Yeah.
Like who?
Like Rachel.
Like who?
Rachel.
Rachel?
Yeah.
Can you see her in your imagination?
No.
When can you see her?
When it's lunchtime.
Oh.
I've spent my entire adult life in the radio business. I've been a music host, a news host, and I was lucky enough to help create this show and have been a producer on it since the beginning. But if you ask my family, my radio career got started a long time before that. I don't know if my feelings on getting dirty and imaginary friends have stayed the same over the years, but one thing that hasn't changed is that I still love making radio. And while all the producers that work on Sound Effect, Jennifer Wing, Posey Gruner, Gabriel Spitzer, and myself, all have very different personalities, we share a passion for making great stories for you to listen to. So each week this month, a Sound Effect producer will pick some of their favorite stories they've worked on over the years, hop in the host chair, and bring them to you. Today, I get to share some of my favorites. What do you think about that, little Kevin?
Okie dokie.
So one of the things you might notice if you pay close attention to the stories that I produce is that I really like stories that involve music. In fact, all of the stories in this show today touch on music in one way, shape, or form. And this story turns back the clock to a radio program that featured a lot of musical amateurs. The show was called The Original Amateur Hour Radio Show. This was one of the most popular broadcasts in the United States back in the 30s and into the 40s. And it was out of New York, but it had this very particular connection to the Pacific Northwest. That connection is a guy named Edward Bowes, known to his audience as Major Bowes. He created the original Amateur Hour, but he also helped shape Pierce County. Here's a story of how Major Bowes went from South Sound land developer to famous radio impresario and champion of amateurs everywhere.
Four great cars, Plymouth, Dodge, DeSoto, and Chrysler, again bring you your friend, Major Edward Bowes, and his original Amateur Hour.
Okay, to say Edward Bowes was a genuine entrepreneur would be a great understatement. He grew up in San Francisco in a poor family, and you could say he started his entrepreneurial lifestyle as a teenager, doing calligraphy for nameplates or invitations for fancy dinners or weddings. And as he got older, he continued to work for himself, but also capitalized from being in the right place at the right time.
San Francisco, a prospering metropolis in the year 1906, gay and festive just after Easter Sunday. Then, on April 18, at 5:14 a.m.
A massive earthquake followed by several fires devastated San Francisco. But from disaster, Bowes found opportunity. Within days of the earthquake, Bowes started buying up destroyed property around the city and eventually became a very wealthy man through his property development. But he didn't stop with San Francisco.
He had to fellow from the Pacific Northwest come down and talk about the rapid growth of Tacoma, Washington, and that it was the fastest growing city probably in the country at the time.
That's Blake Serena, an educator and city councilman in Faircrest.
And I believe the next day, he and a group of his investors left. It was October 18th of 1906, came up to Tacoma, Washington, and was shown around the city.
Bose and the investors hopped on the streetcar, which went from downtown Tacoma all the way to Steilacoom.
And the last real big hunk of property left on that line was Faircrest. And when he saw the land that Faircrest was on, that's when he decided he would make his move and purchase the land that Faircrest is on today.
Okay, now a little background here. When Tacoma was awarded the bid in the late 1800s to be the terminus for the railroad line in Washington, there were some grand plans for the city. Michael Sullivan is a principal at Artifacts, a historical preservation company in Tacoma.
Charles Wright hired Frederick Law Olmsted, the great American father of landscape architecture, to do the first master plan for Tacoma. And the plan he came up with were all these curved streets and parks and, you know, beautiful odd lots and just a city like no other in the world in 1873.
The problem was Tacoma was growing too fast and developers had to settle for a simpler city design.
So that Olmsted plan is always this kind of mythic dream of what the city could have been. It really was kind of left up to Bose to come along and complete, to execute, really, the kinds of ideas that Frederick Law Olmsted had.
And that's exactly what Bose did. Blake Serena says Bose, realizing those ideas couldn't be implemented in Tacoma, put them and his own unique ideas to use on his new land, which he called Regent's Park, later to become Faircrest.
Looked almost like a resort, the way he had set it up. There were little gazebos that were set up, and they had their own zoo. They had a kangaroo and a couple of other animals there. And he made this, I guess, a utopian society that he wanted to create in Faircrest.
Bose's fingerprints are all over what is now Faircrest, and he left his fingerprints around Tacoma, too. He built a hotel attached to the Pantages Theater, the Hotel Illington, named for his wife, the actress Margaret Illington, and the Bose Building, which still stands on 9th and A Street in Tacoma, built out of very expensive Vermont marble. Eventually, Edward Bose's interests changed. In 1910, he sold Faircrest and started buying up vaudeville theaters around the country,
which led him into becoming involved with the RKO Keith Circuit, which was the great vaudeville circuit.
That's longtime television producer Albert Fisher, who worked on the original Amateur Hour after it transitioned from radio to television.
And that became so popular that Major Bose then went to New York City, and he built the grandest of all of the theaters in the vaudeville circuit, which was the Lowe's Capitol Theater on Broadway in New York City.
Eventually, though, vaudeville started to die out, so Bose changed the Lowe's Capitol Theater from a vaudeville house into a movie theater. But attendance wasn't great at the theater, so Bose came up with a variety of ideas to get people to come in, like giving away free dishware. And then he thought, why not an amateur night?
So he started having amateur night where he would host it. And then he realized, well, gee, I've also got this radio station, WHN Radio, and I'm always in need of programming. Lo and behold, this became the cornerstone of that radio station. And it became so popular that his good friend, General Sarnoff, who owned NBC, came to him and said, why don't we take this nationwide? And so in 1935, they did. They started broadcasting the Major Bose Amateur Hour as a national radio show. And it was the most popular radio show in the history of broadcasting at that time.
And now, here is Major Bose.
Good evening, friends. On this opening day of autumn, we spin our weekly Wheel of Fortune for the 236th consecutive time. Around she goes, and where she stops, nobody knows.
Okay, so think of the original Amateur Hour as kind of an American Idol of the 30s and 40s. Listeners would call in each week and vote on which amateur they think should win. And some of these amateurs got their first national exposure on the show.
The most famous one from radio certainly would be Frank Sinatra.
The man's got curly hair. My teeth are pearly, and they also have pearly teeth.
And indeed, they not only won, they became three-time winners. And I think that was probably the first and last time that Frank Sinatra ever asked for a job.
I could rest up.
The Amateur Hour, also with Major Bowes, discovered a lot of very famous opera singers. The most famous would be Maria Callas, who was only 13 years old when she was on the show, and her father did not want her performing. And so she appeared on the show using her singing teacher's name, Nina Foresti.
Nina Foresti? Nina Foresti. All right, what do you want to sing?
Something from Madame Butterfly.
All right, go ahead.
There were just a whole slew of people from the radio era that became famous because of Major Bowes and the Amateur Hour.
And it wasn't just people who became famous. Major Bowes would leave his impression on the entire entertainment industry. Have you heard of the Gong Show?
In the old vaudeville houses, if an actor is bad on a vaudeville stage, they would do what was called give them the hook. Well, Major Bowes realized that on radio you couldn't hear the hook. So he developed the gong. And actually, I'm in my office here in Los Angeles, and I have that original gong of Major Bowes that he used on radio and then on television. And here, I'll play it for you. Here's the famous gong from the Amateur Hour.
The show began to suffer during World War II. Wartime telephone restrictions kept listeners from being able to call in with their vote, which was one of the biggest draws to the show, and radio news became more popular. Major Bowes retired from the original Amateur Hour in 1945 and passed away just 1 year later. But his impact is still very visible, be it on a small Pierce County town or in today's television talent shows. It's really hard to miss.
Let's see what the judges have to say. All right. Champion Tanya Burno receives 3 1/4 stars. Your challenger Britney Spears receives 3 3/4 stars.
The winner of American Idol 2005 is Carrie Underwood!
Until Thursday next, then, I thank you for Chrysler Corporation, its dealers, the amateurs, and myself. Good evening, friends.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Kevin Kniestead, and each week this month, a producer on Sound Effect is sharing stories they've worked on that meant a lot to them. This happens to be my week. This next conversation deals with art and tragedy intersecting on a college campus in Seattle. Marcus Haney is a video producer and a photographer. He's captured some big names on film like Elton John and Coldplay. In 2014, Marcus was asked to produce a music video for a British band called Bear's Den. His idea was this: film his younger brother, Turner Haney, and his friends, all students at Seattle Pacific University. Marcus wanted to capture youth on the brink of adulthood. But on June 5th, 2014, the day filming was set to begin, something horrible happened on SPU's campus. Aaron Ybarra walked onto campus with a shotgun and opened fire. Two people were injured. One was killed. He was 19-year-old Paul Lee, a freshman. Paul was Turner's friend. Turner Haney and his friend Katie Reagan, who was also going to be in the video, sat down to talk with me back in 2017. Turner told me that the shooting happened as he was picking up his brother Marcus, the photographer, from the airport.
I had to make a stop in Georgetown on the way back to do some repairs on my car. And that's when I was in the waiting room of the auto body place. There's another guy just flipping through the channels and flipped past the news channel and I saw my school. So I told him to go back, and that's where I started knowing what was going on.
I was working at a retail spot downtown, and I overheard a woman in the store talking on the phone with somebody. I couldn't really like hear the specifics, but I basically heard like, they think there was an, you know, armed person on campus. There were shots fired. We don't really know what else is happening. And at that point, I automatically knew like somehow that someone that I knew was affected, that something was going down at my school.
I came back and just looked for my friends and, you know, the same friends that we were doing this video with. It was clear that nobody knew anything. We were kind of all just trying to get in touch with whoever we knew.
There were just like floods of phone calls and everyone just trying to keep tabs on everyone that they could immediately think of, making sure that they would answer their phone or that, you know, that they were safe.
We still didn't know who had been injured. So as the night progressed, like there started becoming this conversation forming on my floor in the residence hall. There's one kid that nobody had been able to get in touch with yet. And my roommate pulled me aside and he was going to be a residence advisor the next year. And so he was kind of privy to this information. He said, keep this down, but it's looking like it may be Paul. Once it got later into the night and we couldn't hear from Paul, a few people pulled their mattresses out and were waiting by the elevator for him. And pretty soon after that, everybody's mattress was out.
It's a really small school. Like if there was, you know, even one person that got injured, you probably know them or you know of them or you know someone that knows them really closely. And so it was just a lot of trying to figure that out and just trying not to go insane while you're doing it.
When did you find out that Paul had been killed?
It was the next day.
I think, yeah, because there were two other students that were in the hospital. And so they didn't release any of the three names until, I think, later the next day.
We were just overloaded, not really knowing how to feel. It didn't feel real.
It was just like, let's all just try to get through it. Like, that's all anyone could really handle at that moment.
Can you tell me about Paul? What was he like?
He was hilarious. He was a riot. he was somebody that everybody just really enjoyed being around. He dressed a little thuggy, but he was just the nicest guy. He was always the life of the party. He's a great dancer. He loved to dance.
Even if you didn't know Paul, you knew that he danced.
Yeah.
And you had probably seen a video of him dancing at some point.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
How did you guys sort of cope initially?
We wanted to be together. It was the cast of this music video, but it was the cast because we were close friends. It just kind of happened to be that we all knew Paul. So we just kind of needed each other and just needed to be together.
So when did the conversation happen with your brother about whether or not you guys were going to still do this?
I think I brought that up the day after the shooting, you know, in the context of maybe doing it, but doing it for Paul. This is, you know, a unique situation, and right now we have the platform to do something significant and maybe show the public an intimate view of what a school shooting looks like from the inside.
And I mean, Marcus was really great about it. We all sat down the night after the shooting and he's like, hey guys, like, this is probably the worst situation that is, or the worst thing that's happened to a lot of you. So if you're out, no hard feelings. But if you want to do this, it's going to be awesome. And it's going to be one of the worst weeks of your life, but we're going to try to make something good out of it.
That was when we really started listening to the song and listening to the lyrics. The name of the song is Elysium, and it's by Bear's Den. The opening lyrics are, brother, do you believe in an afterlife?
Brother, do you believe in an afterlife where our souls will both collide in some great Elysium way up in the sky?
That was another reason that we decided to do this video, was that somehow it became so relevant and so applicable to the situation.
For the next 3 days, it was on, and that was what we were listening to, and that was kind of a way to, I don't know how it happened, but that song was meant for that scenario, and just the fact that we got to experience it and that we got to, you know, listen to that song and really process through it, I think was just incredible.
Every page I turn, I only find myself feeling more alone.
What happened next?
Marcus would put us in situations and just let us do what we were going to do, except now there was this element of us doing it for a purpose. What came through was this video of, you know, you can see us kind of needing each other there. Just like another dimension to what it would have been. There's this close group of friends that's loyal to each other, but now they need each other.
Is there a moment in this video that's personal to you or stands out to you?
There's like one little scene. We were all inside one of our friends' houses and we were kind of dancing around and we were playing and we were flipping through the TV and we found a news station that was playing footage from our school that had happened 2 days before. And we all just kind of stopped and, you know, stopped mid-dance move, you know, mid-drink, whatever, and just kind of like stared at the TV for, you know, a solid 5 minutes, just in complete silence. And I look over to my friend Natalie, who's in the video, and we both just start crying and I hug her. And that's kind of like the turning point of the whole video where it kind of goes into the grieving and the sadness that we were all feeling. You know, I have that clip in my brain and I, you know, play it back very regularly. And it was just this horrible kind of realization that like, yep, this still happened. This wasn't a dream. Like, this is actually going on.
You know, there were times where, you know, crying just didn't fit anymore. And so we'd just be talking about Paul and just laughing, laughing our ass off at the that he pulled.
One of the scenes that sort of jumps out to me in this video too is when you put a sweatshirt down.
Mm-hmm. I made a stencil that said "Dance, Paul," and spray painted it white on the back of the sweatshirt. And the end scene where we're walking, and we end up at the memorial and the flowers and the candles and the notes, with people still all around it. Just laying that down and leaving that for Paul, that was something, you know, I was going to do regardless. I'm glad that I just barely had enough time to make it a part of the video.
You both said that, you know, if you guys were going to do this, you wanted to do it for Paul. Was that successful?
Yes. The biggest thing for me was, this is probably going to reach Paul's family, Paul's brother. How are they going to view this? And I never felt fully at peace about the video until over a year later. My brother forwarded me an email that he got from Paul's brother. And that was the point that justified it all for me. I don't care what people on YouTube think, or whether they think it's a good video, or whether they think we're hipster kids taking advantage of a situation. If Paul's brother thanked us for the video, that's what I was looking for.
Just hold out against the night. Guard your hope with your light.
Turner Haney and Katie Reagan from an interview with me in 2017. The 5-year anniversary of the SPU school shooting was June 5th of this year.
The cold wind made your cheeks glow, shivering away under your coat. Berlin was all covered in snow. All I could offer was a hand to hold. So we made our way to the memorial. You traced your hand along the wall. When they put on the video, I felt your hand tied in mine.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad, and today I'm sharing some of my favorite stories that I worked on for the show. For this next story, we're going to rewind almost 100 years. For African Americans in the 20s and 30s, segregation lurked all over, and that included the nightlife in Seattle, especially if you were or wanted to go see a black musician. But on a little sliver on Jackson Street, African American musicians found a home. The Black and Tan Club was not only a place for the likes of a young Ray Charles or Quincy Jones to grow, but also that rare spot that welcomed an audience of all races. Paul DeBarros is a music writer for the Seattle Times and author of Jackson Street After Hours, The Roots of Jazz in Seattle, and he shared his story with us.
There were two entertainment districts. There was the White Entertainment District and the Black Entertainment District. The White Entertainment District was along First Avenue, and in downtown there were huge theaters like the Pantages Theater, which is gone now. The Paramount, a lot of them built in the 1920s, but some of them, like the Moore, going all the way back to the early 1900s. Seattle had been a major stop on the vaudeville circuit.
Georgie Porgy is a guy who is very bashful and so shy. The ladies prize him. They idolize him. You can find him most anywhere.
Black people could go to those shows, depending on which theater they were at, but black performers weren't allowed to play in those theaters downtown. They didn't play at the Paramount. They didn't play on KOL radio. They didn't play at the fancy clubs on 1st or on 4th. They were not permitted to play there. The Musicians Union, Local 76, like many unions around the country, with the exception of the one in New York, was segregated. And it wasn't just against black people. It was a white union. If you were a Native American or Filipino, you were also not welcome. So African Americans formed their own union, the Local 493. So it was never written down on paper, but the areas of town that were reserved for 493 and politely left to themselves was the area around 12th and Jackson, the Central District, and Madison. They were reserved officially by the unions for the African American Union. As far as we know, Russell Noodle Smith started the club. He didn't just open the Black and Tan. He opened a lot of clubs, and he had a lot to protect. The thing you have to understand about Washington, even before the 1920s, alcohol was illegal. I mean, we had prohibition here in 1916. So Noodles had a lot to protect. He was running illegal businesses. Joe Derensberg, who was a wonderful, wonderful musician, said the Black and Tan, during the years that he worked there, had this elaborate system where the booze was all hidden behind panels, and it came down in tubes to fill up people's glasses. So when the cops came, this red light would go off, and all the tubes would get sucked back up into the wall, and it would all be hidden again. It was like a movie, you know, from the 20s. So what you had is a place where mostly African American people were going to basically just have a good time in the neighborhood, which they didn't feel comfortable doing or weren't allowed to do in the white neighborhoods. The Blanket Hand was a really small place. If you walk south on 12th Avenue South past Jackson Street, there's a what used to be a purple door. I think the last time I looked, it was still purple, but very faded. That's the door downstairs. And the club occupied the basement part of that building that's on the corner where there's now a Vietnamese grocery store. Mostly, the bands that played there were combos. And when we're talking about the famous big name first tier players, somebody like a Coleman Hawkins or Duke Ellington or Ben Webster, if they came by the club, it would have been after their major gig at a place like the Pantages Theater or the Civic Auditorium. And, you know, jazz musicians, it's like the gig's over, but the night is young. So especially if you're a young man, and most of them were, it's like, well, where's the action? And, oh, man, it's at the Black and Tan. Let's go down there and see if this town has any cats that can cut us. And it was like a cutting contest, a jam session. And they would go and jam there till 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning. I think it's true to say that those scenes in general offered a public space that was much more open to the integration of black and white than the country at large. And that speaks to jazz's forward thinking and getting the ball rolling much earlier in terms of the integration of the races than the rest of the culture. Jazz was way ahead. If you love jazz in the 1930s even, you probably thought, wow, African Americans are like really smart, creative people. They would have to be to make this music. So suddenly this horrible image of African American people that was prevalent among so many whites was just washed away. Because once you heard Lester Young or Count Basie or Fats Waller, you'd be shaking your head and saying, wow, that's pretty amazing.
No one to talk with all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. A misbehaving, saving my love for you.
So the Black and Tan is no exception to that. I think it's a place where black and white could mix on the basis of all respecting this African-American bred music, jazz. And let's not leave out the Japanese Americans here, because, you know, the Central District was a really mixed neighborhood, especially before the internment of the Japanese. It was Japanese, it was Jewish, it was Italian, and it was black. So it was definitely a space where the races mixed. Just the name Black and Tan. I mean, Duke Ellington wrote Black and Tan Fantasy, which is one of the greatest pieces of music in jazz history, about this contrast in white and black culture. But my take on it is the average person thought of black and tan. It was a place where white people and black people could mix in a relaxed way in a social club atmosphere and dig it. Going through the newspapers, every day of the newspapers from 1900 to 1960, the PI and the Times, there are all these reviews of these third-rate chamber groups playing European music badly. And there are no mentions of the black and tan. There's nobody who recognizes that young geniuses like Ray Charles and Quincy Jones and Ernestine Anderson and later Floyd Standifer or Buddy Catlett are even in their midst. They are completely invisible to the public at large. The only people that know about this at all are the people in the community itself, in the African-American community in the Central District, the Japanese-Americans are going to the clubs, and the few white people that are going to the clubs. So just the fact that these places existed allowed the flowering of an American culture. That's huge. If they hadn't been there, if the cops had come down and said, like they might have in Mississippi, and said, not only can you not play downtown, you can't play here either. Where would those people have gone? Would we have had the music they created? Would we have had Little Richard, whose first record was produced by Bumps Blackwell, who came up in this town and who hired Ernestine Anderson and hired Buddy Catlett and hired Quincy Jones and had him playing behind Billie Holiday when Quincy was 15 years old? It's a huge, huge contribution to the cultural history of Seattle and the cultural history of America. And I think the other thing that really set Seattle apart is reflected in the music that racial tolerance and that racial mixing gave rise to. Because the people that came out of here in those days, particularly Quincy and Ray, their music is marked by a refusal to acknowledge racial boundaries. Quincy and Ray and Bumps Blackwell had a completely different attitude. Like Ray later, why can't I sing country music? And Quincy Jones would play at Broadmoor and play a schottische, you know, like a European dance. He didn't see anything weird about it. It's all music. I want to cross these boundaries. And look what we got, you know, from him we got Michael Jackson, you know, because he produced Thriller. We got this serious melding and fusion culturally from those people. And I honestly believe that it was Seattle that helped make them that way.
Oh, you give your hand to me.
Paul DeBarros is the author of Jackson Street After Hours, The Roots of Jazz in Seattle, and he covers music for the Seattle Times.
I'm the lucky guy, oh, you never, never know, the one who loved you so. Well, you don't know.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Kevin Kniestad, and all this month, the producers of Sound Effect are sharing some of their favorite stories that they've worked on. To wrap up this show of my favorite stories, I'm going to share an essay I wrote a while back. Sometimes we let our emotions take over, and our thinking can get a little cloudy. And if we decide to act on these emotions, well, oftentimes nothing good can really come of it. I found myself in one of these situations 3 years ago. It happened in a bar in a small town in the middle of Washington. Everything was going great for me that day until a very famous young man entered the room. I feel like I never, ever, ever get out of town. So when I do take some time off, I just want to relax. And the best way I know how to truly relax is to go camping. So this last Labor Day weekend, I went to this little tucked away bit of land in Salmon Lissac, Washington, a handful of miles away from Clee Ellum. It was beautiful and perfect, even with a little bit of rain. As the weekend came to a close, my friends and I decided that on our way out of town, we'd make one last stop for a cocktail before facing the reality of heading back to work. So to enter or exit Salmon Lissac, you have to drive through the town of Roslyn, which has a population of about 900 people. It's also home to the historic Brick Saloon, which has been continually operating since 1889. It even still has the original 23-foot running water spittoon along the length of the bar. The perfect spot for one last libation before heading out of town. On this particular day, the Brick Saloon was busier than I assumed it might normally be, but by pure luck, right as we walked in, three seats at the bar opened up by the entrance and we saddled up. I took that as a wonderful sign that this would be the perfect ending to a relaxing weekend. I sat between my two friends, filthy from camping, but I didn't care. While they were thrilled to have cell phone service again, I sat there silent in kind of a rested daze, at peace with my whiskey, as customers came and went from the saloon entrance behind me. This part of the Brick Saloon was for ages 21 and older only, and the youthful appearance of a patron entering the building must have caught the eye of the bartender. "Can I see your ID?" she asked. Since my back was turned to the entrance, I couldn't see the person whose age she wanted to verify, but I could tell that this person wasn't breaking stride. And then he responded, "Google me. Google me. Google me." He said, "Google me." But the bartender didn't say a word, just sort of stood there with a blank look on her face. I turned to my bar stool to see this guy from behind, still not breaking stride, walking towards the pool tables in the back. Gray sweatshirt, white jeans, white high tops, short blondish brown hair, and tattoos on his neck. I turned back towards the bartender, who still looked a bit in shock. And then she said it. "I think that's Justin Bieber." Justin Bieber. Now, I have to tell you that I have always felt there's an especially warm place that entitled cocky young pop stars go when they die. And while I can't say that I know anything about his music, I think there might be a song where he says baby a lot in it. Everything I've ever heard or read about him sounded awful. Justin Bieber, the guy who was given a baby monkey and when he tried to take it into Germany with him and didn't have the proper paperwork, just left it there at the airport. Justin Bieber, the guy who allegedly shut down a major strip in Miami so he could drag race. Justin Bieber, the guy who kicked the Argentinian flag off the stage at one of his concerts in Argentina. Justin Bieber, the guy who urinated in a custodian's mop bucket. And many of you might remember his last trip to Seattle because he got a lot of press for it, for walking out on a $130 bar tab at a bar in Belltown. And on and on and on. And as it turned out, this was most certainly Justin Bieber in the flesh and blood. Patrons indeed Googled him, trying to see if the tattoos on his neck matched the ones in pictures of him online. They did. It was him. Now, has he ever done anything to me personally? No, but for him to stroll into a bar in the middle of nowhere on my last moments of vacation, I took that very personally. Was no place safe from arrogant, troublemaking pop stars? Why this place, in this small town, on the one weekend I get away? Why him? As he stood by the pool tables holding a pool stick behind his neck horizontally, with his arms sort of draped over on either end, this Jesus on the cross sort of posture, it became clear exactly what I needed to do. I was going to walk over to Justin Bieber and punch him right in the face. Now, I am not a violent man. I've never been in a fight, and I have never punched anyone in the face. I can't say that I've even really been tempted to. Not only that, but punching Justin Bieber in the face would have almost certainly landed me in jail, and I had to be on the air the next day, so it probably would have cost me my job, too. But I was overcome with an emotion that I have never felt before. It was as if I wasn't just going to punch Justin Bieber in the face for disrupting my last few moments of tranquility, but I'd be doing it for everyone out there that has seen or heard on TV some of the awful things that he has said or done and said to themselves, "Man, I'd really like to punch that guy in the face." And there are lots of people that want to punch Justin Bieber in the face. Google it. And here I was with that opportunity. I got up and I walked to the bathroom, deliberately walking right by him, just to see how high the adrenaline would get when I was that close. It was there. I could do this. After leaving the bathroom, I walked outside for some air, once again passing Bieber, who was now enjoying what appeared to be a taco salad. It was the moment of truth. My nerve was up. I just needed a sign to tell me either go do this or don't. And that sign came. As I stood outside, it hit me that the social media element to Bieber being here would probably kick in soon. And right as I completed that thought, I saw a girl who couldn't have been older than 14 bolting up the sidewalk and up to the door of the bar. While too young to enter the bar, she had her cell phone in hand, ready to take as many pictures as she could of the inside of the bar every time the door would open. Her eyes were wet. She was practically trembling. For better or for worse, Justin Bieber has brought joy to millions and millions of people. That song that I thought he sang where he said baby in it a lot, I looked it up and it's been viewed almost 1.5 billion times on YouTube. That's a little less than 5 views per person from every single person in the United States. So basically, me punching Justin Bieber in the face might make me the good guy to a few millions, but I would be the bad guy to a couple billion. And who, I ask of you out there, wants to be the bad guy to billions of people? I walked past the shrieking teen back inside the bar and took in the view of stardom for another couple moments. Young Bieber had clearly reached the limit on the amount of attention that he wanted to receive as he was turning down posing for pictures. That's one of his things now, by the way. No pictures with fans. Google it. Popped his hood over his head and passed me while heading for the door. There's this stigma that is often attached to misbehaved teenage rock stars, that they act this way because they never had real parenting or a real childhood, that they never got to develop normal social skills because they grew up on a tour bus and never had anybody real to talk to. I've never found that as a justifiable excuse for terrible behavior, but for a moment, as he walked out, he struck me as human. Before the door could shut behind him, the voice of a teenage female outside of the bar was heard yelling, "I love you, Justin!" "I love you too," he shouted back, before hopping in the back seat of a black SUV and disappearing into the Roslyn sunset. Justin Bieber fans refer to themselves as Beliebers. And I remain a staunch non-Belieber. But if your music can bring so much joy to one teenager that it convinces one grown man not to punch an almost grown man in the face, then maybe there is a reason to believe after all. I don't know. Google it. That'll wrap up the show this week. Sound Effect is produced by Jennifer Wing and Posey Gruner. Our regular host and senior producer is Gabriel Spitzer. We had help this week from Arwen Nix, Ali Ferguson, Aaron Hennessy, and Kari Plogue. Max Wasserman is our intern, and our executive producer is Matt Martinez. You can find our podcast in all of the usual places. We're on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, Spotify, etc. And please send your feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. Next week, we continue our month-long run of featuring stories worked on in some way or another by one of our producers, when we welcome producer Jennifer Wing to the host chair to share some of her favorites. I'm Kevin Kniestead, and this is KNKX.
Over and out.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.